Hello, and welcome to DSAIA's podcast, where we tackle issues that impact the Down Syndrome Association leader, whether it be board or staff. We just want to talk about things that interest you, and today we're excited to have you joining us. I'm your host, Dina Tharp, the Executive Director of Down Syndrome Affiliates in Action. I'm also a mom to a son with Down Syndrome and an avid fan of collaboration. Today's podcast is all about Founder Syndrome, and it was recorded during the DSAIA Happy Hour just a few days ago. We hope you enjoy it.
So today I have Mandy Pierce and Maria Palacios.
Marie.
Why did I say Maria? Because I'm so worried about your last name.
That's what happens when you marry a Salvadorian guy.
Oh, okay. All right. And thank you so much, guys. You guys are for funding for good. And I kind of want to start out, as I know we're going to have a lot of people jumping on because everyone's always 5 minutes late. Tell us a little bit about you guys and how you started Funding for Good.
So I was scammed into success. I lost my job unexpectedly when the economy crashed in 2008. And I had always been grant writing. That was not my employment at the time, but I was putting an ad on Craigslist for my grant writing services. And someone from California contacted me to teach a class in Charlotte. They said that the instructor had been sick and wanted to know if I could fill in. And it turned out, short story from the long story, is that it was a huge scam. They had people from all over the country pay $500 and come to this 2-day class. And they told me they were going to pay me to teach it, $1,500. So I drove to Charlotte, where they had shipped all the materials, and all these people flocked in, and nobody got receipts, nobody could get in touch with the company after I started the class. It was just horrible. I never got paid. Anyway, so after 3 months, I had all the materials sitting on my table in my house, and I said, you know, I could teach that class. And so I created my first grant writing class in 2009, which was hugely successful. And that was the beginning bloom of Funding for Good. And we started services in 2009 part-time and went full-time in 2014. We've been going strong ever since.
Great. Marie?
Tough thing to follow. I did not get scammed. I got convinced into
I think maybe you might have gotten scammed.
Maybe. You didn't know it. Mandy and I actually met through a kid from the circus. I was running
Mexican circus.
I was running an after-school program for Latino youth. Mandy was working at a local group home, and she called looking for services for this young child. I found out she had a grant writing background. I was overwhelmed with program activities in the nonprofit world, and I said, I'll watch this kid from the circus view until we find his parents if you'll help me with some grant writing and some development work, because I'm just all out of time. So that was nearly 15 years ago. And I transitioned, became the executive director of several nonprofits. And as I needed to develop new things, I would contract Mandy. Mandy would subcontract me. And we've been partnering literally for over a decade now. So it's just been a natural progression.
Awesome. That's great. Our topic tonight is Founder Syndrome. And we throw that term around a lot. But you guys, she's got Founder Syndrome, or our founder has Founder Syndrome, or I'm scared I might have Founder Syndrome. But what are the real symptoms of Founder Syndrome?
Well, it depends on who you ask. You know, most founders will say they are symptom-free. So they may say, I don't exhibit any symptoms.
Nina raises her hand. I don't think
And the rest of us might beg to disagree. But lots of Founder Syndrome symptoms. Founder syndrome is basically, it's been defined lots of different ways, but we say a disproportionate assumption or a disproportionate kind of claim to ownership of a nonprofit that one starts. I like to kind of consider it as a parent, like the helicopter parent that never let go. It's the person who started that nonprofit and they've just not been able to let go. Even though their child's no longer in Pampers, the nonprofit's no longer in its infancy, they just can't let go. So it's really the not letting go. And there's lots of other kind of things that play out there, but the not letting go is a big part of Founder Syndrome.
Right.
Doesn't mean they have to walk away. It just means no helicoptering.
But it might not just be one person, right?
Oh.
There are often groups of people who start nonprofits, and there is, you know, sometimes they start as volunteers, and they're like, oh my God, we should start a nonprofit. We've been doing this for 3 or 4 years. Now we want to get funding and be more organized. And so sometimes there is that connection between a group. We usually see that dissolve over the course of time, and some people are able to let go. And then a lot of times there's conflict between who's ever left, because they both think they have the same rights to running the organization or being the dominant figure at that organization. But yes, it can definitely be a group as well.
And that's the self-appointed successor. So you may have the original founder, and then you may have a self-appointed successor who says, you know what, I've been here pretty much all along. I didn't open the doors, but I've been on the ground. I'm the one that got these resources or got the facility. And if so, anyone who's played a major role or has really invested in the process can really come down with a case of founder syndrome or founders-itis.
Founders-itis. I guess so that would also mean like a set of original board members or
yes.
something like that.
But it could be an executive director. A lot of times people start an organization. Mandy and I were actually just teaching a workshop today. We had awesome participation, nearly 30 people in the workshop. And we were dealing with board development and founding nonprofits. So we were doing Foundations 101. And we had lots of nonprofit founders in the room. And when we broached the topic of, are you going to choose to be a board member and govern the organization and know that you're going to rotate off in a few years, or are you going to be, most of them say, no, I want to be the executive director and direct it. Then we say, you work at the will of the board. Are you willing to be hired, fired, supervised by the board, knowing that they could replace you at any point? And you see the panic on the face. So we usually go ahead and start preparing founders of new organizations for this to hopefully impede some of those, you know, those symptoms. We're trying to do preventative health here in the nonprofit world.
It is hard. And I say this because I am a founder of an organization, not this one, but I'm a founder of a local Down syndrome association. So yes, it's very hard. I had to move halfway across the country. So I kind of, my baby was ripped from my arms. But they did just fine.
It's very difficult, but we told people today, tax ID status, the nonprofit status is granted by the government to an organization, not an individual. So that's one thing to remember is you created a nonprofit for the purpose of achieving a mission or achieving a vision that is greater than any one person. And when you establish the nonprofit, you're saying this is an organization because I can't do it alone. And the idea is many people say, well, wait a second, I am the nonprofit. No, the tax ID status was granted to the organization. There were founding board members. There will be new staff and volunteers. So essentially, it means that you should be preparing that nonprofit to grow on and last long beyond your time with the organization. And it's just really hard thing to do.
So
like investors.
Yeah. But I mean, that's where it kind of, you know, how we address it, getting real with it, is that it's, you know, it's not really on, like, I hear this a lot that you have a new staff member that comes on, maybe you have a founder on the board, or maybe you have a founder kind of hovering around, kind of a, I'm still here kind of thing. It's not really just for that new staff member to worry about, isn't it? Kind of it's a whole board issue. And I think maybe sometimes the executive director, you know, whoever's in that role feels like they're dealing with it all by themselves, but it's really not that. It's a whole board issue.
It should be a board issue because it's not the staff member's job to manage the board in that way. If the organization is set up with a strong foundation and it's functioning the way it should, the board should be managing that. And, you know, part of the beginning conversation that we have with people, because we get this call all the time, hey, I want to start a nonprofit. Like, do you really? So I have that conversation. She's the nice one. I'm the super blunt one. So I'll ask people, do you want to give up your baby or do you want to own it forever? Because if you want to own it forever, you don't want a nonprofit. You want a regular for-profit business. And if you don't want to own it forever, nonprofit is perfect for you, but you have to be able to cut those ties. So, you know, if we're able to meet with people before they get to that point, sometimes we can nip those things in the bud, but a lot of times it's after the fact, 20 years later, and we're still dealing with the same founder that's been on the board for 20 years, which is crazy. So yes, it should be a board issue. It should be something the board is having a conversation about on a regular basis. And there should be bylaws and term limits and all those things that the board should be putting into place, policies that protect, that's Marie's favorite term. But a lot of times they're either not following the policies that they have established or they don't know what they are.
And it comes down to the board's role. We have three fiduciary board roles, and one is duty of care. And that means a board member needs to make informed decisions that are in the best interest of the organization. And when all the information is getting funneled through the founder, they're the ones making those reports. They're kind of driving the conversation with the executive director. Board members cannot really act on that duty of care. So it's impeding the board's ability to operate according to the law. Then the next one is duty of loyalty. And the loyalty is to the organization and to the mission, not to an individual, even if it be the founder. And what happens is the board's or the organization's founder is the one that populated the initial board. So people are loyal to that person. They remember the original vision. But once again, that loyalty becomes misplaced and the board as a whole is essentially stripped of its ability to to adequately address duty of care, then duty of loyalty. And then there's the issue of the bylaws. Duty of obedience means you follow your policies and your bylaws and all of those things that are designed to protect your organization. But many times that founder has found a way to say, well, everyone else is going to rotate off except me. Or in emergency situations, someone can stay on and it always tends to be the founder. So essentially, best practices dictate that board members operate with those fiduciary roles, those three fiduciary roles, and the founder can impede all three of those just by kind of stepping in where not needed.
So, when you're talking about these policies that you're putting in place to kind of protect against this and kind of make it so that there's the policy, and there's none of this conversation going on, well, we don't really have a policy on that, so I'm going to stay on, or I'm going to help with this, or I'm going to fill that role while so-and-so is on vacation or whatever. So what are some, what are some of those policies? I mean, you don't have to get specifics, but just, you know, how do you, what are you looking for? What kind of wording are you looking for there?
Well, all nonprofits have bylaws. You have to have them when you establish your organization. And 99% of the time, most of this stuff is covered in the bylaws because it will say things like you have to have a minimum number, you can only have a maximum number of people on the board. It lists officers that you should and or have to have. It lists term limits that you should be. So it could be like two term limits of no more than 3 years apiece, and then you have to take a year off. Right? Or it could be 2 4-year term limits or 1 4-year term limit or whatever. But there are limits, and it's usually written into the bylaws. Most people have never read their bylaws, especially if you're not the person that founded the organization. You just come on and start working. And if you haven't been having good board policies and procedures and appropriately run board meetings and governing by your board, you may not know those things exist. You might not know to ask, what's a bylaw? You know, when I started my business, I'd never run a business before. So I was like, I didn't know I had to run an annual report. What is that? Who does it? What do I say? Who do I give it to? How much do I pay for it? Like, you know, you have all those questions you didn't know. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it already exists in the bylaws. Maria, tell you about the other policies it protect.
So you have lots of different ways.
like a tag team policies. Thing. It's just like.
So fun. The bylaws are the biggest. And what most people forget is they see the bylaws and it says, and the founder is serving in this special advisory role for life. And they're thinking, well, it's in the bylaws. We must adhere to that. But there are always ways to amend bylaws. And that's part of your bylaws as well, is how do you amend them? So you can say, okay, we need to amend this. It's going to take 10 days. We have to present it to the board. So it might be necessary to go through the amendment process rather than just accept the fact that the first bylaws were flawed. Or that there needs to be, it's time for a change. Maybe they weren't flawed. Maybe the organization truly depended on that founder, just like a child depends on its parents through a certain period of years. But at a certain point, we turn our children over to send them to school. We are trusting educators and other people to help shape and mold our child. Then that founder has to trust the board members and the process. So another process that we're talking about, our policy, is your board recruitment policy. How do you recruit board members? How do you make sure that you're not recruiting intramural level board members? You're getting an A-list team. And if you have a policy to recruit the best of the best, and they know what's expected, and they know the vision of the organization and how to get it there and what they're doing, what's expected of them, then it's easier for a more equipped and empowered board to take control and kind of nip it in the bud and find the best role for that founder. So it doesn't mean removing the founder from the organization's life any more than a parent's going to remove themselves from a child's completely. But eventually a child begins to make their own decisions. The board should eventually be able to say, we'd love you to continue to be a supporter. Once you rotate off the board, you can volunteer or contribute in these capacities, but no decision-making power after a certain period of time. Just like parents lose that ability to make decisions on behalf of their young adults.
So maybe moving them on an advisory board is a great way to keep them involved and let them help with big decisions. Especially, I think advisory boards are great. They're kind of like research tanks, I think.
It's historical. We have groups that have coffee together, people who've been on the board or were there during the beginning, charter board members, and they can meet up and they can help with the orientation of new board members. They can help provide the history of the organization for volunteers. They can help with volunteer orientation, things that allow them to exercise their passion without controlling and, investing too much power in the organization. So there is a role for the founder. It does not mean that all things about this syndrome is negative, because you have amazing energy and passion and time commitments that the founders are putting in. So you don't want to just say, walk away, it's not your baby anymore. You want to find a role and a place if it's appropriate, and they can continue to do that without hindering the growth.
So let's talk about it, the staff's role, executive director. Maybe you have someone that's in some other type of role that has a higher level, like program director or something like that, that feels like maybe there's something going on. What would you suggest that they do? How do they contribute to, making this a nice transition rather than it being a tug of war, a struggle for power?
So I'm going to let Marie answer this, but what I will, just my contribution to it is, most of the time executive director is heavily involved with the board. Often the development director is involved with the board, but beyond that, you don't typically have a lot of interaction between the board and other staff, and really probably shouldn't. There's not really a reason for that. So it's more of an executive director helping when possible and when able. And I'll let Marie tell you, it's like where the board begins, where the board ends and the staff begins, there's definitely a division of what each should be doing. And I think a lot of organizations get very blurred lines because they've had a lack of leadership in one place or the other, or both. They've either had a board that really didn't know what they were doing, so the executive director had to step in and kind of overstep their bounds, or the board really had to help the executive director because they didn't know enough about the organization, or maybe they were new, they overstepped their bounds, and then the balance kind of got out of whack. But I let Marie take. She's had this problem. I have.
We'll say not problem, challenge.
Yes.
Unique challenge.
That's right. Never have problems. Absolutely. They're just opportunities to show how awesome we are.
So, looking at clarification of board roles and staff roles is the number one thing you can do. If the board agrees on their job description and the staff member's job description, that is your first kind of line of communication. We're saying there is something on paper. We know what's expected of you. We know what's expected of me. That's number one. Number two is clear channels of communication. So what we typically see is a founder will offer to do things that no one else wants to do, like, I'll be the primary contact for the staff and I'll help the staff with this fundraiser or to launch this program and all those important decisions. And the board is happy to say, sure, go ahead and do that, because it means they're not having to do it, right? So I would encourage, if a founder is working with the staff directly, it's not always a negative situation. There are some founders who are incredibly understanding. We work with those as well.
I still help.
Exactly. There are some people who are a little bit more capable of letting go. So I would encourage you to establish a very clear channel of communication where the founder is not where the buck stops. Because if that's where the problem is, the executive director is left without a resource. And that leads to burnout, frustration, and probably a staff turnover quicker than the organization would like. So it's really unhealthy. So I would say a personnel committee or an executive committee or someone other than the founder that is committed to meeting with the executive director, ideally the board chair, but if that's the founder, then members of an executive committee, and say, okay, we are going to review evaluation performance. We'd like to get your feedback on how things are going, and be able to provide an outlet and very clearly say, we understand there's going to be a unique challenge with working with the founder. We understand they have a clear idea of how things should and could be done, but we hired you because we trust you. We hired you because we believe in your skill set, and we would like to empower you to take action. If you feel at any point that that's not happening, we'd like you to provide a written document or a written account of why you feel like that. Like if it's, I tried to plan this event and the founder blocked me or will not allow me to communicate with donors directly, or every time this founder goes out in the community, they're committing me and the organization to things. And then to save face, I have to say, sure, I will do that. That happens a lot. So very clear expectations on the founder cannot commit the organizations to things that are staff responsibility or board's responsibility to commit to. The founder cannot schedule things and put it on your calendar, you know, even if it's a meeting. The founder cannot show up at your office and say, I need to talk to you. There's an issue that's not priorly scheduled because you have important tasks to do. So establishing very clear guidelines on how that communication and partnership is supposed to work. And if at any point there's deviation from that, you should share and say, Mr. or Ms. Founder, this is where I'm struggling. Let's have this conversation with the board. But by putting it out there in the front, it you become less defensive and it becomes less of an attack. And it becomes, these are the guidelines, these are our operating norms. And when you step out of line, it's easier for the board to correct that without the executive director feeling like they're risking their job or their relationship with that founder. So very, very clear outline of how that conversation is going to look.
Let's look at, you know, do you know what's in your bylaws? And, you know, is there anything in your bylaws that might need to be changed? And that might be something to throw out there for these lovely ladies who are giving their time.
Sure. Bylaws, strategic plans are also a really great mediator between board and staff, because sometimes, you know, your founder will come in and say, I was out in the community and this opportunity came up and we should do this event. And you're like, that is awesome. That is a fabulous idea. But our strategic plan says that we have our fundraising plan and development plan includes one annual signature event and these other things. And I'm afraid that I won't be able to give the attention to this that the board has already approved if I take on another activity. So always use a strategic plan. So if you don't have one, that's something on your list.
It's also your strongest fundraising tool.
It is your strongest fundraising tool, but it's also a great way because your strategic plan includes your goals with strategies and timelines. And if you feel like a founder or founders or anyone exhibiting those kind of micromanaging tendencies comes and throws more on your plate, you can always refer back to that and say, this is the strategic plan. This is the roadmap that's been approved by our board of directors. And as a staff member, I feel like it's my duty to fulfill these and I have specific goals that I need to be accomplishing and I simply can't add more to my plate. Let's definitely consider that in the future. Let's put it in the kind of idea area. Let's park it for now and then come back.
Isn't that the best thing about a strategic plan at some points, especially as a staff member, where you get to say, that sounds like a great idea, but our strategic plan is already in place and we have all these things, you know, our blinders are on a little bit and I love that idea and let's park it and discuss it maybe for the next, you know, or if we reevaluate our strategic plan and decide that we need to go a different way, then we will definitely look at that idea.
I like to say, so the board is my boss and they tell me what we need to do, which right now my guidelines are the strategic plan. Would you like to present this idea to the board and let them decide what current tasks you'd like to take off my to-do list?
What do you recommend as preparation for the founder to exit?
Good succession planning is a key. And that should be part of the strategic plan. Succession planning is incredibly important. And you have to realize that when you lose the founder, now it depends on the founder's personality. There are some abrasive founders and there are persuasive founders. So you may have a founder who is absolutely loved and adored in the community, and their absence is going to do more than just affect the day-to-day operations. It's going to impact the way the community relates to you, how the community sees you. So you have to really consider all of those things. So I would say a key evaluation of what have been the key, the functions of the founder. What are the things that this founder has been doing at the board level? And who on the board is going to step up and take over those responsibilities? So do you have someone that he's gonna or she's gonna mentor during a year or 2 year process? What is that process gonna look like? And then what are the day-to-day tasks? Because more often than not, those founders are in, you know, got their sleeves rolled up. So what have they been doing? The other huge thing is donor relations. A lot of the original dollars come in from the organization because of the charisma and the just passion of that founder. So having the founder make key introductions to local partners, to donors, you know, and that should include board members and development staff. many times donors or founders guard those resources. They like to be the one that controls, well, I'm the one that reaches out to this donor. They only want to speak to me. And that's really kind of like a dog holding onto their bone. We need to be sharing those resources within the organization, because if the organization has hope of survival, you have to be able to retain those resources and retain those donors. So strategic introductions and crafting a message for the exit. So the board needs to work with the founder to craft a message so that staff and the community are not, you know, it doesn't look like a hostile situation and a boot out. It looks like a smooth transition where the founder is going to be excited to explore other ways to engage, and that the organization is stronger for it, even if there may be a loss. So I think messaging is another huge thing, but there's just lots of steps: board, day-to-day operations, donor relations, partnership conversations, and finally, you know, what is that message to the community going to be?
I'm here if you need me, because I think that's what the founder is supposed to do, right? Call me if you need me, you know?
It's hard, and it can be a love-hate relationship, because I know most people will say, I love this person as an individual, I just simply can't tolerate working with them because I feel like I'm not equipped or I'm not empowered to do my job. So how do you manage that love-hate, that I love this person individually, I respect them tremendously, but it's out of line, it's impacting my ability to really serve this organization? And I think that's when you have to start realizing that everything in writing is really helpful, and having an objective way to do that, because when we let things boil up, I know as an executive director, it's easy to get overwhelmed. You've got clients, you've got other employees or staff working under you, and then you have a board asking you for justifications, and then you have a founder expecting you to complete his vision or her vision, and you weren't there 30 years ago when this started, or 20 years ago, so you have a fresh vision and you don't feel like it's welcome. So having a clear outline of, these are the ways we're going to express things. How can we say, instead of this person did this, let's look at the action. Let's look at the action and the consequence versus the person. Instead of he did this or she did this, this is what was done. This is why it was inappropriate. And this is what needs to be fixed so that we can be successful. And when you focus on that, the board is able to focus on resolution versus the conflict. So it's the conflict and the resolution. But also looking at ways to honor that founder, whether it be through a naming opportunity, naming a special program, or your first endowment. I think that sometimes founders feel like they're getting kicked out versus, hey, this organization, I've brought it up to maturity, and now the organization's ready to grow. They kind of feel like, okay, I'm getting kicked out. So how do you honor the legacy and all the investment that that person has done? And that would be key conversations with the founder to say, what is it about the organization that means the most? If it's a children's program, if it's a specific event, what can you do to honor their legacy through an endowment, through, you know, not just a plaque, but something that's going to really show the community that this founder is still honored and has contributed to the legacy of, you know, the work that's being done in the community as a whole. So I think there is that love-hate relationship, but if you can express it clearly and then also express gratitude, it goes a long way.
Tell us a little bit about what you have going on, and if anyone's interested in the other things that you do, Funding for Good.
So you can find us online, fundingforgood.org, or we're on Facebook or YouTube, and we actually have a couple of webinars coming up. Some online master classes and things like that. We are going to be doing, oh gosh, we literally just posted it. It'll be posted later today. Money for Your Mission.
No, it's faith-based fundraising where missions and money meet.
Yes.
How to raise dollars in the faith community.
Yes.
If you are a faith-based organization or you're seeking money from churches or faith-focused donors, then how do you do that? And you'll walk away with templates on how, you know, templates that you can present to churches or philanthropists that like to give to faith-based groups or even humanitarian groups. You don't have to be a faith-based groups, because many of the humanitarian outreaches in our community are essentially extensions of the church. I mean, it's, you know, most churches believe that they're supposed to feed the, you know, feed and clothe and care for the widows. So even if your mission is not faith-based, but you are meeting those human needs, most churches feel like that's an extension of their work. So how do you access those faith-based groups and support your cause?
What's the name of that? What's the name of that workshop or presentation again? Faith-based?
Faith-based fundraising, where missions and money meet. And it's going to be October
20th something.
23rd, I believe October 23rd.
It'll be up tomorrow. But we also have a free grant writing webinar coming up in October. We're going to have, I think it's in November, but we'll have a how to fully fund your overhead webinar. A lot of people have a hard time getting their rent and salaries and the power bill covered. And so we talk about how to create a budget that allows you to do that through fundraising, whether it's grant writing or individual asks or annual campaigns. So we really do a lot with fundraising. And we have an entire group devoted to helping people with grant writing and messaging and creating templates. And it's called the Writer's Block. So we have that group that specifically exists to help folks grow and increase their revenues through their writing and messaging. So we have a lot of free stuff. If you go to our website, there's a tab at the top that literally says free stuff. Click on that. We have all kinds of templates and downloads. They're all free. They're in Word. You don't have to convert PDFs to Word documents. They're all Word.
Great.
And there's everything from sample request letters to
free strategic planning checklist if you're in
job
the middle
descriptions
of
for your board.
Bylaws, sample bylaws.
All kinds of stuff you can use right now. So, and we have lots of videos on YouTube. So if you enjoy watching us talk, then you can go there and watch those.
And those are usually anywhere from 2 minutes to 10 minutes. They're short. They can, you can watch one with your morning coffee, pick a topic of your choice. Yeah.
Wake up with Mandy.
Wake up at imminent, at least it's like chocolate.
Ideas to re-engage our founding, our founding members. Want to see them involved again.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, you just got to give them the opportunities and ask. The number one reason people don't engage and don't give is because you don't ask.
Yes.
So if you're wanting that, you have to ask. Give them a reason to want to be engaged again.
And it may be that you're having a special gala or your signature event and that you want to invite them as a guest of honor, like it's your 10-year anniversary or 20-year anniversary. So definitely think special occasions. You might just invite them to coffee and say, you know, I just wanted to have coffee with you. We are bringing on a new group of staff and board members, and it's important for them to know the passion and the story, because when you go out in the organization, board members, staff members become ambassadors and they become storytellers. And we do lots of grant writing templates. And when I ask, what's your organizational history? They say, our organization was incorporated in 1999 to do X, Y, or Z. And I'm like, that means nothing to me. It doesn't speak to my heart. So what is the story? So we have a client that we've been working with recently, and she said, well, my husband was on the football field and realized none of the kids knew where Seattle, Washington was when they were talking about ball teams. So he started a game to teach geography. And that was the birth of an organization. Super cool story. It was personal. So the stories get lost when the founder moves on and those founding those charter members. So it might be that you engage them in some storytelling where they come and they share stories. Maybe they write an essay or they write something about the organization, stories for the newsletter. Maybe they become a contributor to the newsletter and share stories, or maybe they become a partnership, you know, champion where they help do prospecting. We do prospecting exercises all the time where we say, okay, this is a need we have for the organization. We need a new vehicle to transport clients. And we get the board member, advisory board members. You could call the founder and say, we're creating a prospect list to meet this need. Do you have any ideas? So really just asking for suggestions. So engage them in prospecting, engage them in upcoming events, special guest for the newsletter articles, anything like that that allows people to see and learn the story and the history of the organization is always a really special way.
Thank you for listening to the DSAIA podcast, and special thanks to our guests today, Mandy Pierce and Marie Palacio of Funding for Good. We've included a link to the blog post that inspired this talk today. Be sure and check that out in the description. And please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast and be sure and share it with others.